طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. There's much to talk about today, but we're going to focus on two movements which are shaping the new dialogue on the Palestine-Israel dynamic. We are going to continue to explore the intersectionality movement, which is linking a multitude of human rights struggles together, thus increasing their power to affect change in each of their movements. In this first segment, we feature Palestinian activist Linda Sarsour and Black activist Mark Lamont Hill in an Al Jazeera recorded conversation discussing the linkage of the Palestinian rights movement with the movement for Black rights in the United States. As we have noted in the past, that linkage is essential to effect change in our Black congressional leadership in the United States, to have them begin to understand the common goals of the civil rights movement to the Palestinian liberation movement, and hopefully to begin to unshackle them from their allegiance to Israel. Here are Linda Sarsour and Mark Lamont Hill on Al Jazeera.
Hello, Linda. Hello, Mark. I am not going to introduce you, but I want you to introduce yourself in the context of this discussion. Linda, you start.
I'm so honored to be here. My name is Linda Sarsour, and I am an unapologetic Palestinian-American daughter of Palestinian immigrants to the United States of America. I'm also a racial justice activist and have been on the streets of the United States for the last two decades, fighting for Black and brown communities, marginalized people. I'm a leader in civil disobedience and direct action, and I'm just very happy to be here with you, Femi, and also with Mark.
Mark, in the context of what you do, who you are, introduce yourself to our stream audience.
I am Mark Lamont Hill. I am a professor who studies the issue and question of race in the Middle East. I am very interested in the Afro-Palestinian population in the Old City of Jerusalem. I am someone who studies transnational solidarities between Black Americans and Palestinians. I am an activist. I am an organizer. And I am a former commentator for a major cable news network and currently the host of Upfront right here at Al Jazeera. Yeah,
I'm glad you can laugh about that right now. All right, so we'll mention that in just a moment. I feel that you are both highly qualified, so you can both stay and be on the rest of this show. All right, so Mark, let's start with recent news from the Gaza Strip, from East Jerusalem. People around the world were watching this news. People in America were watching this news. How do you feel it played out? Online and offline, did you notice anything different about the way Palestinians and their cause was being reported or shared?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the first thing is that the Palestinian cause was being reported and shared.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you look in the 1970s, I mean, you think about the refusal to even say the word Palestinian. And it wasn't just Palestinian. I remember Peter Jennings talked about this when he was I believe in Lebanon. He was in Beirut, and he was talking about how the media in newsrooms only would say Arab. It didn't matter whether you were Syrian, whether you were Lebanese, whether you were Jordanian, whether you were Yemeni. It didn't matter. You were just Arab. And so to fast forward from that moment to a moment now where not only are Palestinians identified, but the actual cause is being pointed to and spotlighted, not as effectively as we would like to see, but surely the conversation has shifted. I mean, when we saw the initial uprising in Sheikh Jarrah, the first thing that I saw was an honest attempt by some media outlets to say, hey, wait a minute, this is a violation of international law. hey, wait a minute, they're displacing people who are in an occupied territory. That didn't happen before. You know, some people still wanted to call it a real estate dispute, but many people saw it for what it was. And then once we got to what was happening in Gaza, the question became, is this just Israel defending itself, which is what the narrative has been so long, particularly Operation, if you look at Operation Cast Lead, Operation Protective Edge even, it was less so, but still the case. But now there was some honesty in reporting. People talked about disproportionate force. People said, has Israel done too much? People were critical of Netanyahu, and people had some principled representations of it. And let me say one more quick thing. A big part of that is not because major cable news outlets or major network news outlets had a philosophical reorientation. They didn't get religion. They didn't fall off their horse. What happened was everyday people got access to media. Suddenly, you have people in the old city showing their own experiences. You have people in Aqsa Mosque showing the police pummeling them 3 days before Eid. And when you see that stuff, it's hard to ignore. And similar to when George Floyd got killed, no matter how race blind and color neutral you want to be, when you see that man dying in front of your eyes in the United States, you got to do something about it.
So, Lindsay, here's our show thesis. That change that Mark described, that change was partly due to the Black Lives Matter movements of today.
Absolutely. I believe that fundamentally as someone who is part of the Black Lives Matter movement, but also the longstanding solidarity that Black people have shown to Palestinians. We can go back to Kwame Ture, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael, and Angela Davis, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the U.S., but of course, Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela, and leaders across the African nations. For me, the Black Lives Matter movement has been very deliberate about making the Black Lives Matter movement a global struggle, a global social justice movement, which then kind of portrays this principle that our liberation here in the United States of America, the liberation of Black people, is bound up with the liberation of people all over the world. And so when Black people are in the streets, when Black people are raising their voices in the United States as a continuation of a civil and human rights movement, people start paying attention. And that's why I always say, when Black people are free, we're all going to be free. Mm. And so watching Movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter, and I mean that in the general sense of people who believe in this idea of sanctity of Black life, you know, their the integration of Palestine has been very unapologetic. The endorsement of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement has been truly unapologetic. And have they received backlash for it? Absolutely. But what the Black Lives Matter movement has done is never backed down. And that is why this past summer, and even before, but also just continuing into today, having statements come out of leaders of the Black Liberation Movement has been extremely not only important and beautiful to see as a Palestinian American, but has also been quite influential in politics in the United States and really around the world.
What moved you when you heard statements? Because I saw a lot of Palestinians saying thank you. Right. They were seeing celebrities tweeting and putting themselves out there on social media. They were saying, thank you, we feel seen. What moved you, Linda?
You know, for me, Femi, what moves me is that every day as a Palestinian American, I have to fight for my identity. I have to explain who I am. And there are oppositional forces every day who get up every morning to try to erase my identity as a Palestinian. Tell it, you know, there's narratives out there that there's no such thing as Palestinians, as mm-hmm. if I and my family walking around are like a figment of our own imagination. And so to see a movement that is also oppressed, people that are also marginalized, people who are fighting for their own existence and their own dignity, saying, wait a minute, we are also fighting for the dignity, and to see the existence of the Palestinian people thrive is beautiful. It's everything that I dream of being part of a movement that sees liberation bound up with one another.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I have seen and heard you describe why Black people and Palestinians, why there are parallels between their experiences. I've heard you unpack that, describe it. Our audience gets it. This is Liz Rainey here on YouTube. I think the foundation was laid by people like Nelson Mandela, openly comparing apartheid in South Africa and Palestine and standing against it, one of the OGs out there. And then on Twitter, very close parallels between Black experiences, both South African and American, at the heart of apartheid in South Africa. Scores of people, including kids, get killed by the state security for simply protesting. Our audience are on board with this. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, no.
I think that's important to know that the world is beginning to see parallels. But I'm always equally hasty to point out that solidarity does not hinge upon, nor does it require, sameness. Our circumstances are different in many, many ways. It's not about who has it worse. It's not about whose oppression is more urgent. It's about, on the one hand, saying, yes, there are systems and structures that connect us, right? Systems of power. White supremacy is a global system. Capitalism is a global system. And so the same forces that oppress someone in Brooklyn will oppress somebody in El Bire, right? That's just the reality of what it means to be in a capitalist system. It's what it means to live in an imperialist world where the United States has a very particular invested interest in having outposts in the Middle East, whether it's through Saudi Arabia, whether it's through the state of Israel, whether it's through increasingly Jordan and Egypt, whatever the case might be. So we have to think about the connections. We have to think about state power as a connection. We have to be able to say that the state, the nation state itself, which is a relatively new and modern idea, functions in certain ways. This nation state itself is occasioned by violence and erasure and dislocation and dispossession. And so the same system that takes Native Americans in the United States and displaces them and erases them and ultimately in some ways blames them for their own death, it's not surprising that we'll see the same thing to someone who's Yazidi in Iraq or someone who's Palestinian. We'll see the same system. So in that sense, we have commonalities, right? In that sense, state violence is a common experience. But there's also ways that our solidarities don't have to hinge just on that, because there's a very particular way that when I fly to and I don't do this, but if I were to fly to Tel Aviv and I can just land and decide that, hey, I'm going to go and hang out in Akka and you know, and go to Nazareth and then go south and go to Tel Aviv or go back to Tel Aviv and then go to Jerusalem. Linda can't do that. She with the Hawiya, with the West Bank ID, may have to make a different set of choices, despite the fact that it's her homeland. So in some ways, I have more freedom of movement than she does in her own homeland. That's not an experience that I can relate to as a Black American. I'm not stateless the way many people are. I'm not bordered by land, air, and sea like people in Gaza are. There's a way, that, in the same way that Palestinians were never enslaved, like we were in the United States. So I don't need our situations to be the same for us to have solidarity. Because a lot of times people say, oh, being Palestinian is just like being Black. Well, no, it's not. Just like being Black isn't like being Palestinian. They're different.
That's right.
But they're equally important. And so I don't need to stand up for Palestinians because I see myself there, but because I know that oppression is real. And so for me, it's the connections, it's the systems, but it's also just the right thing to do, despite the fact that there are considerable differences.
That's right. And it's important, Mark, that you say that, because it's not the same being Black and also being Palestinian like me. But Black people have been experiencing oppression around the world, but specifically in the United States, for close to four centuries. And so it's not the same. The Palestinian people have been under occupation, their land stolen, the displacement, the dispossession has been going on for 73 years. And this is not oppression Olympics. I think Black people are naturally in solidarity with the Palestinian people for many reasons and many that you've listed. But as Americans, the solidarity with Palestinians is seen through the lens of also the economy and watching the military aid that we send to the state of Israel. You know, when I'm in protest around issues of police brutality or even racial justice issue, economic justice issues, we're fighting and saying we need health care for all Americans and all those who reside in the United States. We need access to high quality public education across this country for every child, regardless of their zip code. And we need to open more hospitals and more clinics. And especially in light of a global pandemic that we're in, our government often tells us we are idealistic. We don't have these kind of resources. But we apparently have $10 million that we send to the state of Israel every day to occupy and dispossess and really terrorize the Palestinian people. And that, for me, is how I kind of come into the movements and saying, listen, we need to make these connections. There's also the incarceration connection. Some of these same for-profit incarceration, for-profit prison companies that incarcerate Black and brown people in the United States and make money off of them are the same companies that that profit off of the incarceration of Palestinians in the West Bank and also within Israel, companies like G4S. So there's also an economic conversation to be had here. And for me, also watching the kind of young people who are now engaging in electoral politics in the United States, but really in other parts of the world, particularly in the West, where, you know, we're electing more members of parliament, more members of Congress in the United States of America who are ready to be unapologetic about supporting the Palestinian people. And that's new. We've never seen that before in our lifetime. At least I haven't seen that in my lifetime. And to your point, Mark, about, you know, going to Palestine, you know, I'm an American, and so I carry an American passport. So me personally, I always have the chance of not being let in just based on my activism and really based on, you know, my very vehement critique of the state of Israel. But I have a son who right now is 22 years old, and he carries a Palestinian ID card as well as an American citizen, because of a derivative of his father, who is Palestinian and born and raised in Elvira, Palestine. And my son can't go to Jerusalem. And so when we go to Palestine, and I've been to Palestine many times, we have been separated as a family because there's certain places that I can go and certain places that my son can't go. And I remember this, and I shared this story before, that my daughters, who at the time a few years ago were young, they were young teenagers, tweens even, were basically protested me in my village where my family's from because they found out that their cousins were not allowed to travel to Jerusalem with us on a day trip. And my daughters were so outraged. They said, what do you mean? We're American and we flew on an airplane for hundreds of miles and we could go to Jerusalem and the people who live 15 minutes away cannot go? We are not going. And I couldn't believe it. I just paid $1,700 a ticket for each child. And my daughters were like, no matter what you tell us, we're not going. This is unfair. This is unjust.
Apple doesn't fall far from the tree, Linda. You brought up what you deserve.
One time.
I spent money. Activist children. All right. I want to bring up an acronym that I learned from you, Mark. It's a PEP. What is a PEP? I want you to just describe it very briefly, and then I'm going to play a video clip to you, and I want you to come off the back of it. But first of all, the acronym PEP. What's a PEP?
A PEP is a person who is progressive, except for Palestine. But I want to be very clear. That ain't my acronym. People have been saying that movement for a very long time.
Okay.
That's the language of a Palestinian critique. Not me personally, although I did do a book, which conveniently is sitting here, called
Very Except for Palestine.
Yes, The Limits of Progressive Politics, which I wrote with my dear friend and colleague Mitchell Plitnick.
Who is Jewish. But,
yeah, indeed, he is. And so, it's those people who have progressive politics on all the major issues.
Apart it seems from right. Palestine. All right. So bearing that in mind, now that you know that acronym that Mark has used but he didn't come up with, I want you to have a listen, Mark, to Olivia and then respond to her video comment. Here we go.
Being progressive except on Palestine is easy. We don't learn world history in U.S. schools. And forget hearing anything about Black history, which can be one entry point into Palestinian liberation circles. But the tides are changing, because now we have things like Snapchat and TikTok, as silly as that might sound. Because in this way, we all become eyewitnesses to history unfolding around the world. We get to access what generations of Black and Palestinian liberation circles have been trying to tell us for decades.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the key to the question of the PEP is that we can identify it. We can point to it as a contradiction, but we have to point to it as an unsustainable contradiction, right? We can't say they're a PEP as if it's some quirk, as if it's some personality quirk. Like, he's a PEP. Like, no, we have to see it as a morally unsustainable position. If someone were progressive except for South Africa, if someone were progressive except for marriage equality, if someone were progressive except for you know, ending slavery in the 18th century, we wouldn't say, they're progressive. They're pests. Right. No, we would say that that's a morally unsustainable position. But because of how much we have normalized Palestinian oppression, there's a way that even the Palestinian liberation movement, particularly among liberals and often liberal Zionists, we make it seem as if being a PEP is OK or that if it's a quirk as opposed to something that's actually outrageous. You cannot be progressive except for Palestine.
That's right.
You know, I'm just wondering. You go first. I'll go second. Go ahead.
Now, I was saying, unfortunately, that's actually all over the movements that we're a part of. It's not just like, you know, in one certain space. It's that we come to movement spaces around immigration and people not seeing the connection between borders and immigration and talking about an issue like Palestine or talking about racial justice and incarceration or even talking about, you know, the military industrial complex. Like, Palestine is a part of those conversations if you are a person that believes in global justice. When we're talking about a global pandemic where almost 550,000 Americans died and many, many more across the world, why shouldn't we be fighting for Palestinians to also have access to the vaccine, for example, or healthcare for Palestinians or the right to travel for Palestinians? And for some reason in our movements, people believe that you could be pro-immigration and go stand at the border and say, oh my God, I cannot fathom the separation of families and children, but then you support the state of Israel who does that to Palestinian families all the time. Or when you say, oh, I don't support white supremacy in the United States and I'm going to stand up against white supremacy, but I support the state of Israel who has nation state laws that are literally codified that discriminate against Palestinians and other minorities in the state of Israel, that literally treat Palestinians who live within the Israel as second and third class citizens. So that kind of what Mark is talking about, morally unsustainable, it's also inconsistent. And so I cannot trust you in the movement if your kind of lens around racial justice or justice in general is only in the American context, then you can't seem to apply that across the world. And that is kind of the tension that we found in the movement, particularly around Palestine. And for me, it's not about Palestine being a litmus test. I don't test people at the door of the movements. I don't ask you what your position is on Palestine. But it tells me a lot about who you are if you can support a state like Israel and be able to come to a movement and say Black Lives Matter in the United States. It just doesn't kind of make sense. And also for people who will say, yes, of course, Linda, Netanyahu is a fascist. He's a bad leader. He's, a disgraceful leader in the state of Israel. But remember, Palestinians have been displaced, dispossessed, occupied since 1948. Netanyahu has not been the prime minister of the state of Israel since 1948. So this idea of trying to like use Netanyahu as a boogeyman and everyone's like standing with me on the street saying, yeah, Netanyahu's bad. It's not enough. I need you to say end the occupation. I need you to say lift the siege on Gaza. And I need you to say that you see the liberation of the Palestinian people bound up with the safety and security of Jewish people. And if you don't see those two peoples being able to coexist in a place and be all able to live under one constitution where they hold access to laws, it's just not going to work, Femi. It's not going to work. And the movements are not accepting any other kind of conclusion or resolution to this conflict.
Mark and Linda, I want you to have a look at some pictures that I put together on my laptop because it's sort of a progression of the civil rights movement into where we are now with Black Lives Matter movement. This is Muhammad Ali, I believe this is 1970, visiting Palestinians in a Lebanese refugee camp. Then we fast forward George Floyd murals from around Palestine. Rest in peace, Big Floyd. This is remarkable. And then I'm just going to end here, Mark, on your Instagram. And you shared a portrait of George Floyd hanging in Gaza City. Where are we now? Where does this solidarity get us? What difference is it going to make? Very briefly, Mark.
I believe that it's a re-energizing of those connections that Linda talked about, that since the 40s and 50s, we've seen connections. Since the 60s, we've seen powerful connections. And when you see those pictures of George Floyd on the wall, the apartheid wall in Bethlehem, or when you see it in Gaza City, you see that people are paying attention to what's happening here. And when you see us in the United States paying careful attention to what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in the West Bank, what's happening inside of Israel, what's happening throughout the diaspora, as Muhammad Ali did, it shows you that we're on the right path. But the key now is to test our political will. It's not enough to just say Black Lives Matter. It's not enough to just say Free Palestine. We have to do the work of voting the right way, organizing the right way, spending the right way, etc.
I've got one more question for you, Linda, on YouTube. I'm going to make it very quick. You've got 1 minute to answer. It's a hard question, though. What can we do to help our brothers and sisters in Palestine? Asked Donovan. Good question for you, Linda, to wrap us up with.
Absolutely. I need people to stay unapologetic about their public support for the Palestinian people. Do not back down. Do not worry about the weaponization of anti-Semitism. You are on the right side of history. So keep sharing the stories of Palestinians. As Mark said, make sure in elections that you vote the right way, particular in federal elections, so we can see more Rashida Tlaibs and Ilhan Omars and Cori Bushes and Jamal Bowmans. And also support your Palestinian family and friends, not only those who live, of course, in Palestine, but here, amplify their voices. So I appreciate that question, and Black and Palestinian solidarity forever.
That was Linda Sarsour and Mark Lamont Hill speaking in an Al Jazeera interview. The second movement we focus on today is the Palestinian rights movement on U.S. campuses today. In particular, the development of the Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, movement, which has initiated immense pushback from Zionist campus groups, the well-funded Jewish lobby, and too often their university administrations and boards of trustees. But the energy of campus human rights organization and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement have given enormous visibility to the Palestinian cause, which for so long has been suppressed. Here is an inside look at the SJP story, as told in interviews with SJP students on Amanda Weiss interview.
On university and college campuses across the United States and Canada, student activists are organizing for Palestinian liberation under the banner of Students for Justice in Palestine, or SJP. As the student-led movement has grown dramatically over the last 20 years, so has anti-Palestinian pushback from Zionist groups and their allies. Organizations like Canary Mission, StopAntisemitism.org, and other similar right-wing groups have focused a lot of their attention on the student activists of SJP. Despite this, the movement on campuses is strong and shows little signs of slowing down. Earlier this year, the National Students for Justice in Palestine organization held its 10th annual conference. In today's episode, Michael Aria speaks with three SJP activists about how the movement has grown over the last 10 years and where it is headed in the future.
SJP was started in the early 90s, but it holds its first national conference at Columbia in 2011. Can you talk about the motivation and the impetus behind holding that first initial conference in 2011, please?
So at this point, SJPs were run autonomously. We were just really organizing as individual chapters on our campuses and didn't have a national body or institution that could provide support to us in our unique organizing environments. We had been meeting up with each other at conferences across the country that were put on by various organizations, whether they were Palestine focused or just, you know, social justice conferences. And at that point, decided that we really needed something that could support students on a national level, so we could, you know, share skills, so we could develop ourselves politically. And so at that point, we decided to host the first conference at Columbia, and that's where it all started. And it was a really great opportunity for us to connect with each other, for us to learn from each other. It was a very exciting time.
I was reading some of the articles about that first conference, including in our own archives at Mondo Wise. And a week before that conference, the ADL put out a report for referring to SJP as one of the top anti-Israel groups in the country, and warned that the organization was growing. There was a counter protest at that first conference, and we've seen obviously a lot of resistance to SJP and groups like SJP since. Can you speak about the kind of resistance that you got over that first conference? And I'm wondering whether it was mainly from pro-Israel groups on campus or coordinated attacks from larger organizations like the ADL.
It was a little bit of both. We did certainly face on-campus pressure and resistance, but truthfully, the worst of it came from off-campus organizations like the ADL, as you mentioned. You know, that list came out, but we also had other, you know, we had blogs written about us. We had national organizations coming after us, and there were also members of the community in New York City. You know, folks who were older, not students, coming out to protest us in person. They were carrying signs that were really terrible, really racist. And it was, awful, but it wasn't anything we we hadn't seen before. I mean, if you do organizing for Palestinian freedom, you're used to people attacking you, unfortunately, for your principles. So it wasn't great, but you know, it's something that we've become prepared for and are still committed to what we're doing because we know it's the right thing to do.
Thanks again for chatting with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you to start. I mentioned you were an SJP member from 2015 until recently. I'm wondering if you saw any changes in how the group was perceived or what kind of resistance you faced from the time you joined until more recently when you left. And I was also wondering if anything changed in terms of the resistance you were getting after Trump was elected, since you were there right before he came into office.
First, thanks for talking with me. Great to be able to speak about this. You know, like, first thing to name is that, you know, repression, surveillance, harassment of Palestine Solidarity organizers and their communities is an ongoing issue. And it, you know, wasn't ameliorated with the rise of Trump and the, you know, subsequent sort of liberal hand-wringing at the height of his campaign. So, you know, in that regard, many SJPs had to move in ways that sort of highlighted the, you know, the violence of our so-called democratic institutions on either side of the aisle. It served as an opportunity to build and collaborate with other leftist and progressive issues and movements, you know, seizing the moment by saying, hey, Zionism is violent too. And, you know, white supremacy is a boot on the necks of people outside of the imperial core. You know, my local SJP at the University of Georgia, for example, really quickly mobilized alongside other organizations to establish like a formal coalition made up of community and campus organizations, unabashedly embraced anti-Zionism and, you know, more broadly anti-settler colonialism as one of its principles. And so this really forced self-identified liberals to, you know, reckon with the fact that exceptionalization of Palestine is at odds with the principles that they claim to uphold. Sort of in response to our mobilization, my SJP actually ended up losing its funding after being withdrawn from its departmental membership, which it had actually maintained since it was first founded, maybe like 2004, 2005. That was on the local level. And then sort of on the national level, although noting his many shortcomings on Palestine, Bernie Sanders' campaign also sort of represented a significant shift in the national conversation, you know, owing to the work of organizers who pushed him on it, you know. And similarly, with the launch of the Movement for Black Lives' platform in 2016, expressing solidarity with the Palestinian people, it, you know, drew the ire of liberal Zionists across the country who, you know, as I mentioned before, were forced to grapple with, you know, some serious cognitive dissonance. So there was a lot of anti-blackness that spilled out of that situation. We saw the rise of Canary Mission around that time, 2015, 2016, which has, you know, had varied levels of activity since then. So the repression intensified in some ways, definitely, but it was also a period of renewed strength and commitment to the work, I think, for us. So, you know, Trump's pro-Israel policies inflamed the situation. And even National SJP, you know, we were sort of faced with a situation where following the defunding of UNRWA, we had to deal with the fact that people were understandably redirecting their support to other groups and efforts on the ground to sort of fill that newly created gap. It was an opportunity, and it was also sort of a period of, you know, heightened repression as well.
Can you speak about some of the campaigns that the group was part of at the University of Georgia while you were a member? And then also, I'm just wondering maybe some of the success stories that things you're able to accomplish in that time.
Following the sort of like defunding of our chapter, you know, we had to sort of move in ways that would not deplete our resources. Our funding was minimal, but, you know, we had to move in ways that would sort of, you know, strike a balance between overdoing it, and we needed to sort of continue to maintain our stability and our, you know, standing as an organization. We had to be careful to not burn out, because, you know, oftentimes you see in SJPs their membership usually, like, you know, pays from their own pockets. That was the case for us. We didn't quite engage in any particular campaigns, but we certainly sort of did heighten our participation in direct action. One organization, for example, Reservists on Duty, is an organization which brings occupation soldiers to tour across college campuses in the U.S. and I think Canada. And so, you know, we engaged in, you know, some disruption of them. And that was actually following our first disruption. That was when funding was pulled from us. You know, we were hearing things about administration being contacted and then subsequently, you know, having departments withdraw their sponsorship of an event that we were hosting, for example. You know, but other organizations, other chapters engaged in, you know, there were a lot of divestment campaigns across the country in different regions. On the national level, it's not a campaign, but our annual conference, I think, for National SJP, you know, we had the most widely attended conference in our history in 2018 at UCLA. For many years, you know, NSJP ran the Right to Education Tour, which was developed through a partnership with Brazet University. We brought Palestinian students to college campuses in the U.S. to speak about their experiences under apartheid and occupation. And, you know, that's been a piece of our work for sure. And in part owing to sort of the fact that National SJP was and is a non-hierarchical organization, we don't claim oversight or power over individual Palestine solidarity groups on college campuses, which is something that not many folks know. So, you know, we've historically not been engaged in coordinating campaigns on the local level. You know, oftentimes that work is up to chapters and we're there to support them with resources and trainings. So, you know, some might see the work that Zionists do on campuses, like, I mean, bringing camels to their plazas and sending in, you know, violently racist state-sponsored initiatives and orgs like Hasbara Fellowships and Reservists on Duty and Students Supporting Israel, you know, bringing them all year round. And then folks might ask, you know, why aren't we doing that? And so it can feel really, really daunting, but we have done and continue to do so much with so little. And it's, you know, it's really a testament to people power, you know, like, you know, capital is not going to save Zionism. It's, you know, National SJP has no headquarters or anything, and virtual and remote work has always been our game. So 2020 was really an opportunity for us to be super intentional about building relationships with movements and groups doing incredible work across the country and around the world. You know, we've hosted panels and webinars, trainings, run different initiatives with Palestinian Youth Movement, Red Nation, Anak Bayan, USCPR, Jewish Voice for Peace. I could go on, you know. So we're definitely growing, and the path towards freedom, you know, is ever closer.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, and you've already alluded to it a little in that response, but if you could speak to how cross-campus activism works within the organization. Just, I know we have the conference obviously every year, but beyond the conference, how are you able to coordinate and build with chapters at other schools? How much interaction is there between chapters? And I'm also wondering if you've been able to establish many connections to organizations beyond the United States as a campus organization based here.
National SJP has always maintained that it is not the overseer of SJPs. You know, they have the autonomy to decide where they go and how they move, and we are there to support. So, you know, in that sense, cross-campus organizing is sort of an ever-evolving sphere within the realm of Palestine student organizing. But especially recently, we recognize that NSJP needs to evolve alongside that, especially considering the power that we have, that sometimes we're not always super keen. Maybe, you know, maybe we just don't recognize it, but we have a lot of power. We don't always name it. Right now, our hope, NSJP's hope, is to become a central hub for students across Turtle Island to engage with things like coordinated campaigns, collective education and trainings, community building initiatives, et cetera. So we're really trying to strengthen our network right now to build this cohesive strategy. And again, like you mentioned, our conferences have always served as sort of that central space for skill sharing and knowledge exchanges. So, you know, campuses are better equipped to build power and build power together, especially across their unique situations and needs. Right now, regional coordination is especially important for us. And we're, you know, steadily working on developing some really like innovative ways to communicate with chapters and for chapters to communicate with each other so that we can sort of build out that infrastructure that we need to achieve our goals. So, you know, to sum up, those coordination methods have and strategies have really varied over the years and, you know, have included things like regional conferences. So the Midwest region might host a conference. I think most recently they hosted one in Ann Arbor and they faced a lot of backlash. You know, also regional conferences in the South, stuff like that. So, you know, with over like 220, I think, Palestine Solidarity orgs on college campuses right now, our work is really to develop something more concrete. And that's super vital. To your question sort of about international relationships, you know, in 2020, just this is as an example, the AMED program, AMED program at SFSU launched a series called Teaching Palestine, Pedagogical Praxis and the Indivisibility of Justice. So we have the opportunity to support and engage with like a wide variety of organizations such as Al Qaus, Adamir, Al Adab Journal, Adela, and Semidun, and you know, many more. And those relationships, you know, we're building them. We're continuing to sort of we're trying to grow closer, expand our network so that we can maintain those ties and be responsive to organizations and the people on the ground in Palestine. We're continuing, again, to move towards a more cohesive student movement in a lot of different ways, and the future looks really promising.
Raphael, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Of course, thank you for having me.
You're actually undergoing a rebranding, which is detailed on the group's website. Can you kind of explain some of that?
You know, over the past decade, we've seen National SJP do some really incredible work, right? So we've seen things like the Right to Education tours and these like annual conferences, which brought students together and really helped shape and push forward the student movement. However, the student movement at a local level, you know, was and is currently growing really rapidly. And we realized that National SJP was not at the time adequately equipped to meet the student movement's growing needs. So truthfully, we had served as a conference planning body more than anything else. And we knew that in order to support the student movement, we need to really radically restructure and shift our priorities to building out a more fully functioning organization. So following our steering retreat this past March, we decided that we wanted to initiate this process, which, you know, rebranding came out of. So National SJP imagines a student movement that has the political infrastructure to conduct regional, national, and even transnational campaigns. We want to take BDS, for example, beyond the confines of student government votes and to, you know, the Board of Regents or to university administration itself. So given that we know that that the liberation of Palestine is only realized through the liberation of all people globally, we also imagine a student movement equipped with the knowledge and resources to build coalitions and relationships that are rooted in joint struggle with the aim of collective liberation, you know, hence our conference theme this year. So to build this movement, we took steps over the past year towards creating a cohesive centralized structure for the Palestine Solidarity Movement in North America. And as part of this move towards a formalized structure, we initiated three projects. The first is developing a national structure for SJP. And then the second, which goes hand in hand with the first, is co-creating shared principles and values for the SJP network. And then in order to move us closer to those goals, we held consultations in the fall of 2020, where we talked one-on-one with over 60 SJP chapters. And the last project that is part of this rebranding is the rebranding of our image. So we wanted our image to be reflective of the organization that we seek to cultivate. And the redesigning of our image, was the first step towards cohering and unifying the student movement. And so in thinking about the elements that create our image, you know, things such as logo, website, color scheme, even our font, we were really intentional, and we tried to choose element or choose characteristics that represented the resolve and determination and commitment to Palestinian liberation that we want the student student movement to embody.
And finally, you've alluded to this in some of your answers already, but just on a wider level, you're obviously a campus organization based in the United States, comprised of college students in the United States, but you're aligned with the demands of Palestinians. Can you just speak to the wider vision there? How do you bridge that gap consistently and make the necessary connections, to your mind, between the fight going on here over Palestine and the fight going on in Palestine itself for all these decades?
That's a really great question. Thank you so much for asking that. So I have a couple things that I want to say about this, but maybe starting with shifting the framing just a little bit. So, you're absolutely right that SJP is a solidarity-based movement in North America. In being this, our role on campus and in our communities is targeting the ways in which Zionism most concretely materializes. So that is through university investments, police relationships with Israel, anti-BDS laws, the adoption of the IRA definition, all of these manifestations of Zionism that we see. But rather than thinking of it as two movements bridging together, the student movement is really one important sector of a much larger movement for Palestinian liberation. So I guess I don't think it's necessarily a question of needing to make the connection between our work, since the connections are really concrete, but rather it's affirming the notion that student organizing is a really powerful vehicle in combating Zionism and in pushing forward the demands for Palestinian liberation. So, going off of that, in terms of concretely bridging specific demands and calls, National SJP is grounded and guided by Palestinian grassroots organizations and works to connect chapters with their actions. So, for example, we led a three-part virtual political education series with the Palestinian Youth Movement this past summer, which connected students, student organizers in occupied Turtle Island or North America, to student organizers in Palestine. And we discussed things such as abolition and the role of Palestine student organizers in organizing towards abolition, as well as commemorating the Nakba, which the Nakba is a, the catastrophe which befell the Palestinian people in 1948, in which over 800,000 Palestinian refugees were forcibly displaced from their homes because of Zionist militias. So, you know, in short, we work with Palestinian organizations really closely to connect demands and align students with Palestinian grassroots organizing. But we also see our work and our movement broadly as intimately connected to the Palestine Liberation Movement.
And that is it for this week. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We'll talk again next week.